Well, welcome back to another Squared Away episode here on Charting the Course. It is wonderful to be with everybody today. Hope everyone's having a great continuation of the fall. It's not doesn't feel like fall around here yet, but we're getting there. So I'm joined as always by Austin and Zach. We also have Sam sitting here. These three make up our investment team and just continue to do an incredible job, not only for just the employees here, but just our clients as well. So
Tyler, can I call something out real quick?
Please.
So Sam Warner's here. Sam is not an OU graduate, but he is wearing an OU shirt. And I think he's going to the OU Texas game, correct? Okay. So yes, we are not big on predictions here. Because we think the future is really hard to predict. But
careful.
By the time this comes out, the OU Texas game will be over.
Correct.
But while we're recording it,
right,
it's not here yet. So
looking
over at Austin, who is an OU grad, what's your prediction for Saturday?
Boomer Sooner all the way.
We now have that on recording.
Okay, I will take the other side of that.
You'll take the other
side.
I think
Texas is going to win the game.
I'm afraid to say you may be right this year, but at the same time you can't give up on your team.
All right.
Well, I don't know. In rivalry games, you always have just kind of that unknown X factor, and so that's what I'm banking on.
That's fair. The only OU Texas game I went to, OU was a huge favorite.
You love to tell the story.
I do like to tell the story. And Texas won. So maybe it'll work that way for OU.
Texas didn't just win that one. It was a blowout.
It was a blowout. That's correct. Yeah.
Well, as an Oklahoma State fan, given our season, I'm refraining from commenting.
We could also predict OU or OSU's win-loss record.
Well, let's not.
I don't think it's going to be above 500.
We want this to be a positive podcast, Zach, not a negative one.
Go Pokes. So.
Okay, let's get in here. The fourth quarter is well underway. We've got a few things on the horizon. There's just a lot going on. But let's stop. Let's look back at the third quarter. Look at some year to date numbers. I just think it's a nice. It just paints a nice picture, and it just speaks to really our approach, taking the long term view and everything. So, Austin, you spent a lot of time really pulling this data together. So I'm going to kick it to you. Just kind of high level. Let's go over the U.S. markets. As well as international markets, and then highlight a few things year to date that have gone on that have been interesting to you.
Sounds great. Yeah. No, the story has been, at least last quarter, has been a continuation of how it's been pretty much this whole year. And for the past 12 months, the market has continued to rally and keep reaching all-time highs, not only within the quarter, but we've kind of seen a historic run so far this year. So one of the interesting facts that we kind of came across as we were pulling together this market update is that so far this year, through the end of the third quarter, has actually been the best year for the S&P 500. It's been up 22%, and that's the best year that we've seen since actually 2000. So any of the past 10, 15 years, the S&P has gone up. We have not seen as great of a year within the first three quarters that we have this year.
That's fascinating.
It's been a historic year for U.S. large cap stocks. But beyond that, last quarter, what we also saw was a broadening out of some of the returns within the market.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting.
So obviously the major headlines have been around the Magnificent Seven and some of the large concentration that's been in the market. But last quarter, you actually saw small cap stocks, international stocks begin to outperform even large cap stocks. And so the reason we like to see that is it means the market returns are not just coming from seven names anymore. You're starting to see a broadening out of returns, which is great to see. And you even see it from a sector perspective. So a lot of the news is around technology stocks. But last quarter, the best sector was actually utilities and real estate. And utilities did so well that they're now the best sector for the S&P 500 so far this year, beyond technology stocks as well.
I feel like it's been a minute since utilities possibly led.
Some of the factors there are interesting too, right? Because you've got interest rates that are starting to decline. Utilities tend to have a lot of debt, so that's good for them. And then the other mega trend that we've been seeing is the increase in data center power usage. And that's obviously very positive for utilities. So interesting factors that are leading to outperformance for utilities.
Exactly.
One other note you put in here that I think it's just important to highlight because of something we're going to get to here in a little bit in the market volatility section is all sector returns were positive for the quarter except for energy, which declined by 2%. And there are reasons for that. But if you would have told me in August when we had some pretty crazy days that we would end up with all sector returns being positive outside of energy, I'd been like, man, are you sure? Like, kind of like predicting the OU Texas game we just did.
Yeah. Well, to piggyback on that, Tyler, I mean, as Austin referenced, a lot of the asset classes that have not been performing particularly well, we really saw some life from, one of which is emerging market stocks, which, you know, been in some meetings in the past where people go, why do we own these stocks? They never seem to go up. Emerging markets are historically very volatile. With volatile stocks, you'd like to see them go up and see the volatility of the upside occasionally. We saw that in this last quarter. In fact, as most people know, China is a major component of emerging market indices. They tend to be about a third of the total market cap of emerging markets. But China came out with the stimulus package, which turned out a couple of weeks later to be a little less than what the market was maybe hoping for. But when they announced the stimulus, within a few days, China's stock market went up 22%. Gosh. So, I mean, you can see some very, very substantial moves in that market. And that's why for us, it's just really hard to predict, which, you know, to the question of clients, hey, why don't we wait a little bit and see when things get better, we'll hop back in. You just never know when some of these things are going to get announced or that worm's going to turn, as I like to say. And we saw that in the quarter and certainly benefited by having some exposure there.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like emerging markets and small caps had some of the best performances just in the quarter.
Yep. And the other thing, as Austin pointed out in the market update, the equal weight index. So if you...
Yeah, this was interesting.
Typically, when you turn on CNBC and you see the S&P 500 returns, that is a market cap weighted index, which means that the largest companies, Apple, Nvidia, Google, et cetera, have the largest weight in that index. Alternatively, you could construct an index, and this is an investable, there are ETFs out there that do this. You can own every stock in the S&P 500 at the same weight. So every stock would get 0.20%, which would equal 100 if you multiply it times 500. Equal weight obviously de-emphasizes the largest companies within an index and overemphasizes the smaller companies. Equal weight has underperformed for quite a while as the Mag 7 have outperformed.
Sure.
But this last quarter, equal weight up 9.6%, which outperformed market cap by 3.7%. So again, kind of in the theme of a broadening out of the rally, that was a really encouraging data point for us.
Yeah, it really was, given just our philosophy and the way we structure our portfolios. You guys. All right, let's look at bonds real quick before we move on. We had the, what I feel like we've been talking about for six quarters now, but we had the rate cut announced finally. Fed announced in September they were going to do a 50 basis point rate cut. Your thoughts around that? What's the market kind of, how has it reacted to that? It did not seem to be surprised at all. It seemed fairly priced in. And then what's the market pricing in moving forward to end the year?
Yeah, it was going up to the Fed meeting. Some of the biggest uncertainty in terms of the market not knowing what the Fed was going to do. The market knew the Fed was going to cut, but it didn't know if it would be 50 or 25. And, you know, the Fed likes to say they're data dependent. So everyone was watching very closely data running up to that Fed meeting.
Yeah.
What did happen, and this is really what the Fed would like, they want to signal to the market ahead of time what they want the market to think is going to happen,
sure,
which reduces volatility and creates a little more certainty in markets. So you're right. By the time the Fed actually announced a 50 basis point rate cut, the market kind of took it in stride.
Okay.
So it was not a huge surprise. There were still a lot of people out there who thought it would be a 25 basis point cut. So overall, that's certainly good for all sorts of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a borrower, you're debt costs are going to start coming down, companies in general, and particularly small caps. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about today is related. Small cap companies tend to have more floating rate debt that will immediately start coming down. They'll pay less because of the Fed rate cut, which
helps profits.
Help profits and can help explain some of the small cap outperformance. But
sure.
Yes, the Fed, I think, is clearly signaling that rates are overly restrictive right now. They need to start taking them down to a more neutral level. They don't want to see unemployment go up substantially. Now, since the Fed meeting, we've had a very strong jobs report, which that is kind of impacting what the market expectations for future rate cuts are at this point. I think right now the consensus is somewhere between 1 and 2 25 basis point rate cuts coming up in November and December, most likely, is the expectation. So we'll see. But what is clear is that I think rates have peaked, and barring a really unexpected increase in inflation, rates are going to be coming back down. Oh. If you look out 1 year, for example, December of 2025, Fed funds expectations based on where the market is currently pricing future rates is about 3.1%.
Okay. Zach, you had some really interesting commentary that you wrote in our market update. And again, as we always remind people, if you'd like a copy of a market update, we're more than happy to get it in your hands. We put out a version of it on LinkedIn. If you follow us on there, this should be getting posted shortly, but always let us know. Send a website submission in and we'll get you a copy. But Zach, you wrote about a couple of things. The first one being cumulative knowledge versus cyclical knowledge. And I think this is just fascinating. Really, in our industry, we have to deal with this cyclical knowledge constantly. So you might give some background there and your thought behind that and where you kind of came up with this, this idea to compare these two.
Yeah, well, I shamelessly stole it from Morgan Housel is the answer to that. I mean, I always figure...
I was going to let you say that.
When you read really smart guys, guys or girls, it's wise to take their ideas and kind of try to build on them. So all credit to Morgan Housel on this cumulative or cyclical knowledge idea.
A friend of the pod, by the way.
A friend of the pod, former guest on here, and he's working on another book.
Exciting.
As he announced on his podcast recently. So we'll be sure to... That will very likely be our client gift in a future year. But he had a podcast and a related blog post on this idea.
Okay.
And I thought it was really good. Like a lot of his ideas, it makes a lot of sense. So he uses medicine as an example of a field with cumulative knowledge. So he's a very good storyteller. So he told a story about, I think it was McKinley who was shot, President McKinley, way back in the day. Right. And the state of medicine at the time was such that doctors believed that it was actually good to kind of leave a little bit of grime on your hands, and they were
don't wash your hands,
digging around,
no gloves,
digging around in the bullet hole, you know, looking at poking him. And I mean, of course, he became septic and died. So, of course, we wouldn't do that today, right? And we have the germ theory of disease that's widely accepted. I mean, it's accepted. That's every medical school student looking at Austin again, since his girlfriend is in med school right now. Can I say it?
Wait, say what?
By the time this comes out, I think she'll be your fiance.
Potentially.
Okay? If she says yes. All right.
This is the first time I'm hearing
all
about
this. All right. We'll cut that if she says no. You got to let us know after this weekend. Sorry to digress. Yes. As Sarah knows, germ theory of disease is a real thing. So in medicine, we build upon knowledge that our forefathers have learned, and we get better over time, right? So he contrasts that, though, with cyclical knowledge. Investing is a great example of that. And while the field of investing has advanced a lot, and Daniel Kahneman and Richard Thaler and people like that have helped us understand all these biases behaviorally, and then Benjamin Graham and Dodd and all the folks who are more on the academic side have helped us think about how to price securities,
right?
Think about market efficiency, things like that. You know, at the end of the day, human beings still react emotionally when it comes to investing. And so Housel's point is, you know, even though we know these things, every generation still has to relearn a lot of the lessons. Fear and greed, even though we've seen those cycles play out over and over in the past, it happens again and again. And we write about it and we talk about it here so much, whether it's SPACs or cryptocurrency or the next thing will come along
that'll
down
tempt
the line.
That generation.
Correct. That, and people will learn, it'll feel really good to chase something that's going up. Greed will kick in, and then it will inevitably inflate into a bubble. It will burst. People will become overly fearful. They will sell it. You know, it's just, we know these things will happen. And Housel does a great job of, you know, basically saying he could see a scenario where in 50 years we've cured a lot of diseases, but there's no scenario he can see where in 50 years people aren't reacting emotionally when they're investing. Fear and greed are not going to go away. That's a little bit depressing, maybe, if you want to take it that way. But on the other hand, it also provides a lot of opportunity. If we know that's going to be the case, if you're a intelligent investor, if you can be disciplined in how you invest, it actually creates a lot of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. It really does. And one thing he talked about a lot, just for individual investors, and what we see is, kind of to sum up what Zach said, is you see these large bets, lack of diversification, which leads to that, your point, kind of a bubble bursting.
Yep.
Then all of a sudden you realize, oh, wait, I don't have any tolerance for loss. So then all of a sudden I'm way too, you know, way too risk averse and too conservative. And it's just this. So anyway, speaking of cycles, I think it leads us directly into the cyclical knowledge of the market as it relates to politics in your portfolio. And so this is the kind of the next section you talked about, Zach. And what I think is fascinating is, and you highlight it, in here, but we can have this conversation today and we could go back and have it in 16 and in 12 and in 08. And it's the same conversation. So we'll just rinse and repeat it and have it ready for 2028 when it comes out. But let's spend just a little bit of time here. We've been talking about it. We're less than a month away at this point from the election. And it is just one of the noisiest times in a market cycle.
It is. And you're right. I mean, one thing we wrote about in the winter 2023 market update was, you know, we know it's an election year. We know the media is going to say this is the most important election of our lifetimes. But truly, we've heard that every single election cycle. And it's not that elections don't matter. They don't have consequences. Like, I'm going to vote. I'm sure we'll all vote, right?
Yeah, we vote because they do have...
They do have consequences.
They do matter based on what we believe. Yeah.
But from an investing standpoint, people who make investing decisions that are purely driven by political preferences tend to have worse outcomes. And that's where, you know, I like to say we're evidence-based, we're data-driven. That is incredibly clear. And so, and it's honestly, it's a little bit hard sometimes to have conversations with clients because we have clients who range across the spectrum and have very strong political opinions. And, you know, I certainly respect that. But, and this is credit to downtown Josh Brown from Ritholtz Investment Management.
Oh, yeah.
But he posted this just wonderful chart, I thought. And it was data looking back to Eisenhower's election or inauguration, excuse me, in 1953. And it said, okay, if you had $1,000, if you started back in 1953, you had $1,000, and let's say you're a Republican and you only were invested in the S&P 500 when Republicans controlled the White House, you sat out otherwise when Democrats ran, you ended up with, you turned your $1,000 into $28,000.
Yeah, okay? Woo, good job.
28X. If on the flip side, you're a Democrat, you only invested when Democrats were in office, you did a little better. You're up, turned $1,000 into $64,000. It's not really a commentary that, you know, Democrats are better for markets necessarily.
No, we can
There's a lot more that goes into that.
We can just stop there and basically there's your answer.
Yeah, no. Now, here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
If you just invested that $1,000 in 1953 and left invested, Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
$1.7 million was your terminal wealth.
So $28,000. $64,000 or $1.7 million.
Yeah. And of course, we all know this, right? It's just compounding. It's allowing your dollars to compound over time. Yeah. Some politicians will have better policies or worse policies, but it's clear from the evidence that we're not going to be able to sit here and predict that based on the outcome of the election. And the economy is so much bigger than any person, even the president. It's just not in one's best interest, historically speaking, to be in or out of the market based on who's in the White House.
Yeah. So again, we've got a couple weeks. One thing I loved that was in the market update was how you're going to hear people say, you turn on the news or read the Wall Street Journal, read anything, that this is the most important election of your lifetime. Well, they were saying that in 4 years ago, they were saying it 8 years ago. And again, we're not downplaying the importance of getting out and voting and being involved.
Right.
But when it comes to investing, we are telling you to just stick to your plan, stick to your goals.
Let markets work.
Yeah, let it work. So next section was chasing yield. I think this one was also very interesting. You referenced a Jason Zweig article in the Wall Street Journal back in August, just talking about when interest rates go down, people have become used to this higher yield environment. And so now all of a sudden you start chasing yield. You start chasing that dividend. You start chasing that, clipping that coupon, if you will.
Yep.
So thoughts, comments there from either of you.
Yeah, I like this quote from Raymond DeVoe Jr. More money has been lost reaching for yield than at the point of a gun, which I thought was pretty good. Although my wife said she didn't exactly know what yield meant. So for others like my wife out there, it's just it's income that is coming in from an investment as opposed to, you know, stocks that may go up in price and then you sell it and get the gain that way. A lot of people overemphasize yield because it feels more certain than investing in a stock that is going to get most of its return from price appreciation. So where I have seen this burn people so frequently in my career is they will see a stock that may have a very high dividend yield and they'll go, oh, I will buy that. So I remember Citi, for example, in 2008 or 2000, it would have been probably early 2008, where the dividend yield looked incredibly high because the stock price was plummeting as the market was pricing in the global financial crisis that was coming at the time. And many people thought, oh, that's great. It's Citi. It's a big bank. They'll pay their dividend. I'm going to get 10% plus. Well, the stock went down. they cut their dividend. I think they ended up cutting it to zero, and people just lost a ton of money. And that's kind of the mindset that people sometimes have that can lead to a very bad financial outcome. Zweig's article talked about someone who was guaranteeing a 17% return with no risk, and he, you know, did a little digging and it completely fell apart because the guy was a crook and a criminal. But the point is, people who've gotten used to maybe investing in fixed income bonds, even treasuries that were at 5%,
right,
that's likely going to go away as interest rates go down. There will be a temptation on some people's part to look for other investments that are going to produce a lot of income. And even though that may feel safe, you really have to dig down and understand how that income's being produced, or work with an advisor who can do that work for you, because a lot of people have been burned playing that game.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll add is, whenever you talk about income or yield or dividends, you have two components that you have to consider. You have an income return, but you also have a price return. And for a lot of these products that are promising very high returns, or we've seen new ETFs that have come out in the market that are promising 4 or 5 times dividends of,
yep,
and they're using derivatives to try to buy income that they can distribute. It looks great from cash flow that's coming into your account, but at the same time, you can't do that without giving something up. And you see that on the price side. So while you may be getting a lot of income in the short term, you may also be giving up a lot, or the stock price, the bond price, the ETF right. price may be decreasing over time.
Sure.
And so you have to have that balance. And so there's not this secret formula out there that is going to guarantee something without having to give up something or take some unknown risk that you may not be aware that you're taking. And it can very easily, especially with a lot of these that are using a lot of leverage to, yep, to juice up the returns, to juice up the income that they get back, it can blow up pretty quickly as well. And so it's just always important to keep in mind that there's two components.
Yeah.
It's not just the income or dividends or yield that you get. Yeah. That's important.
It's an excellent point. And we've seen more of those products come out. In fact, the journal, I think last week, wrote about one with like 100% yield is what they were claiming. And I mean, I can give you 100% yield. You give me $100 and I'm going to turn around and give you $100 back, and you'll end up with something worth zero, but you got 100% yield
right.
for a week or whatever, right? That's not great. And what some of them do, it's returning your own capital back to you, right?
Yes.
It's not investing in a security that stays at that par value and is then giving you income. The other thing that people need to be careful of, and some of these covered call products have gotten much more popular. You know, there's use cases for covered calls. We've used them in some of our client portfolios for specific reasons, but there are downsides to that approach too. So when you sell a call on a security, that produces ordinary income, for example, as opposed to if you buy the S&P 500, most of the dividends that companies send out that then get passed through to you are qualified dividends that are taxed at a lower rate, as opposed to the higher ordinary income produced by selling covered calls. So there's just lots of nuances that investors need to understand. And unfortunately, so many people will just look at that one number, what's the yield, and then make an investment decision based on that. And that's just not enough.
It's a great point. It's fascinating. Let's end on something that we're going to continue to talk about until the end of time. And that is just investor behavior around market volatility. So market goes up, market goes down. Everybody's on board with that. It's the speed in which it goes up or goes down and the noise around that. And so another really intelligent writer and investor you highlighted, Zach, was Howard Marks. And he highlighted Ben Graham, who we just referenced earlier. But Graham pointed out, and this is years ago, I mean, I don't know when Graham would have said this, but it's been a while, that the day-to-day market isn't a fundamental analyst. It's a barometer of investor sentiment. You just can't take it too seriously. Meaning the day-to-day swings in the market are just
noise.
Think of like noise. They're like I've called it a screaming toddler at times. It's just whatever the day brings and whatever it's reacting to. So, but this is where we went back and we looked at those few days coupled together there in August where it felt like you would have thought the market was down, going down 10%. But as you highlighted, it was the S&P 500 fell about 2%, almost 2% on August 1st. And then the tech heavy NASDAQ fell 2.4%. So comments around this, any, as you look back on it, things that you're like, man, that was just interesting to watch people react. And it had been some time since we had a pullback.
Well, what's funny, I think if you just asked a person on the street today, you know, how's the market been over the last 3 months? They would say, oh, it's been great. Because they probably, you know, recency bias kicks in. They're seeing all-time highs on their screen.
Yeah, seeing green.
Like, they've already forgotten about early August. And I kid you not, we had someone say to us, it's different this time because they were so worried about, and it was just a handful of days. And we write in the market update about the unwind of the yen carry trade. And I won't go into it because it's not worth talking about on here, but it had a kind of worldwide effect on stocks. US stock market went down. And yes, some people kind of freaked out about it, even though it was just market volatility over a short period of time that is pretty normal over the course of your investing lifetime. But what I hate to see is someone making rash decisions, reacting emotionally to seeing what ends up being a temporary blip in their portfolio going down. And, you know, even watching financial news and, you know, the media, I guess, deserves some blame too. Sure. Some commentators were calling for an emergency Fed rate cut.
That's right.
After a few days of volatility. And it was silliness. At the time, to me, it was clearly obvious, like, the economy's in pretty good shape. There was nothing to point to the Federal Reserve needing to overreact to anything that was going on. But yeah, market went down the kind of very end of July and the first few days of August. By August 7th, I think S&P went up 8 straight days. By mid-September, we hit a new all-time high, and we've continued to make new all-time highs since then.
Well, and it goes back to the thing we've talked about, not only on Squared Away episodes, but just other episodes. I know I've talked about it on Captain's Corners with David. If you miss 1 or 5 or 10 of the best days in the market, you're giving up so much return. So to your point, Zach, if you had gotten completely out on August 7th, or let's say you got out on the 5th, would you have gotten back in on August 8th thinking, oh, well, now we're good. That was enough to take off the top. And you don't. You get in probably by mid-September when it's back at all-time highs. That's when people get back in. So, Austin, you have any comments around this?
The other thing that is easy to do is, and kind of honestly hearkening back to the beginning of the podcast where we talked about cumulative versus cyclical knowledge, when you look at the way volatility, and that's the drastic moves up and down in the S&P 500, when you look at it over time, you have these kind of clusters where it can be very volatile for a short period of time, and then it kind of is pretty stable. And you can kind of get lulled into thinking, hey, it's stable, everything's good. And then it's almost like that cyclical knowledge. We need to learn it again because people forget, oh, hey, volatility can happen. And it just happens in these short windows. And to your point, if you make a rash decision and you get out when maybe you think, oh no, it's going to keep going down, and then the next day it goes back up. So that's where it's easy to kind of get lulled to sleep thinking everything's stable, and then you have these little pockets, and you just got to remember, not learn them every single time, but you just got to remember to stay invested, to stay the course through those. Otherwise, you can hurt the long-term performance.
And I think as we've seen such a strong year in the market, no matter what else happens the rest of the way, it's that tendency to really grab onto a value you see in your portfolio, because we have had market, like, now there's a new baseline with everybody,
anchoring.
Right?
Yep.
Right. You've anchored to a new portfolio value. I did it the other day. I was like, oh man. And then I realized, don't do that. Like, don't start.
You've got to think probabilistically, right? That, okay, we're going to put a plan into place. We know we're going to have up and downs in the market, but if you have a plan, the day-to-day movement, the pullbacks that you're talking about, Tyler, they just don't matter at the end, right? It's very likely to work out if you're properly allocated. And that's what we try to help people do here.
And it's why we tell people it's so important to have an established plan in place or goals lined out. I had a conversation this week where they wanted to put money to work that's potentially needed in the next 6 to 9 months, but they just wanted to earn more than what they're earning in the bank. And I said, not a chance.
Right.
There's no way we can do that. Sure, we could make great money in 9 months. Maybe.
Yep.
But we cannot do that if you're going to sleep at night, if I'm going to sleep at night. Because the second we do that, market's going to pull back.
That's
And the second advice. We don't do it, market's going to go up. So I took my bet, and maybe the market will go up. Gentlemen, thank you guys. Any closing thoughts, comments?
Can't wait to see that game on Saturday.
Good luck. Well, hindsight, I hope you guys enjoyed the game on Saturday. At least everybody was nice. But congratulations to Austin and Sarah.
Thank you.
I love that she's going to have to listen to this knowing we recorded this before.
I know, isn't that great?
And we're congratulating her after.
Well, it's just tomorrow. So.
Oh, okay. All right.
Won't be a long time.
All right. Yeah. So
Austin is also running the Chicago Marathon this weekend. So good luck to you, Austin. And
man, if she says no, you're going to run that thing in about 2 hours and 45 minutes. Yeah. Just haul it. She's going to say yes.
My advice is on any sort of race is you start fast and then you run fast in the middle and fast at the end.
Yeah. That's good. I haven't heard that good marathon racing
advice.
You got this. I heard bananas are good.
Yeah. Pickles. You don't like pickles?
I do not, but this is not a podcast about what Tyler doesn't like. So, all right, y'all, we appreciate it. We'll be back in, actually, we've got a really cool, and I'll tee this up. We've got a really cool episode in November with Dr. Daniel Crosby, who is one of the leading investor behavior guys out there. Thank you. But he's going to be back on the podcast. So I'm really excited about that. He's got a book coming out that's actually going to be our book. We're going to give away to clients this year. So
The Soul of Wealth.
Soul of Wealth. Be on the lookout for that. We think you can buy it now. I think it's available, if not now, by the 15th, I think of October. So everybody have a great rest of the week and we'll talk to you guys again later. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to review and subscribe to your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week. All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.